I think a lot of people overlook the lenders and think that's kind of a guaranteed quantity, if you will. But you got to treat your lenders just like you treat your investors. I mean, they are the largest investors in the deal. You need to build relationships with them. And therefore, if you build relationships with those three groups ahead of time, when a deal comes, you'll be ready to take it down.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Kent Ritter is a former management consultant. He's a startup owner and he's a corporate executive turned full-time real estate investor and operator. He is the CEO of Hudson Investing. They are a multifamily firm based in Indianapolis, Indiana, that help busy professionals scale and diversify their investment portfolio. Kent, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me on today.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. There's three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. Can you quickly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Well, where I started probably come from a few different angles, but I started out, like you said, as a management consultant, started out right out of school and really did that just because I wanted to experience a lot of different businesses. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to own a business someday and I wanted to get really good at understanding business and running them. So I thought that'd be a good way to see, travel around the country and help a bunch of different businesses and understand what really makes them tick. That's where I started. So right now, like you said, CEO of Hudson Investing. I also do a podcast called Ritter on Real Estate. And I'm just having a hell of a good time doing a kind of a second career in real estate. I sold our management consulting business back in 2015. And that really set off my real estate career, taking that capital and personally investing it. And then it kind of grew organically as people start hearing what you're doing and they want to know how they be a part of it and get more and more people asking. And one thing leads to another. Next, we've got about 650 units, you know, that we've acquired and we're holding about 450 right now. And we're just kind of having a lot of fun with it.
Man, that's fantastic. I love that. Yeah. I mean, there's buzzwords in any industry, management consultant. I don't even know what that is really in the end or what that means.
The easiest way to explain it is I would help businesses solve problems that they couldn't solve themselves. So if we flew around the country, I've been to every state but two. I've worked in every state but two, and essentially that's what we did. So a lot of operational work, a lot of financial consulting, technology consulting, a lot of different aspects, but it's essentially what we do as consultants is solve problems.
Right, man. That's fantastic. What skills have you taken from that experience that you now apply in your own business?
Oh man, just from project management and just how to organize and stay on task and set deadlines, how to motivate and influence people, how to provide a vision that people can understand and get everybody moving in the same direction toward that goal, how to create measurable key performance indicators and how to track them. I mean, just so many things that really all relate to multifamily investing, which is what I do now.
How did you pick multifamily investing? So you sell a management company or a management consulting company and you're like, oh, I know, multifamily investing. That sounds right. Or what was the transition there?
Yeah, it wasn't quite as straight a path as that. So we sold that business and I wanted to diversify. And so I started looking into real estate. And I think like a lot of people, you find like what's close to you, right? So we had a family friend who was a commercial lender and he was doing some note buying and things on the side. And so I started getting into buying some notes and building up a note portfolio, did some fix and flips, bought some singles and doubles, and kind of just had to find my way. But really at the end of the day, the reason I fell in love with multifamily is because multifamily had the scale to really get me where I wanted to be. When you start thinking about buying single family houses and you actually do the math on how many you're going to have to buy, once when you realize how hard it is to buy one house, and then you start doing the math on how many you have to then buy to actually get you where you want to be financially, it's a hell of a lot of houses. So it's better to go out and buy 100 units under one roof than to go out and buy 100 houses. So that's really what led me to multifamily. And then still, my mindset was pretty narrow because all I ever knew of real estate was that, well, you go out and you become a landlord. So even with multifamily, I was like, okay, well, at least I'm going to buy 50 units at a time. But my thought was, well, you know, I'm going to own them and manage them and do that. And luckily, you have people come in your life at the right time. I had a good mentor come in and really teach me about syndication and say, you know, that's not the way to go. You need to be thinking about syndicating so that you can go buy bigger and better assets. Then you'd be able to buy on your own and you can also diversify a little bit more. And so that's what I do now to build a business around is just bringing people in to invest alongside me and taking down bigger properties than any of us could do on our own.
Man, that's fantastic. What have been some things that you have learned along the way that you would say were like, oh, this is something I didn't know that I wish I knew earlier on?
Yeah, good question. From a real estate perspective or just in life?
Yeah. Talking more about as you guys have started to buy multifamily assets and you said, okay, we're going to bring some people in, we're going to raise money. What's something you wish you knew earlier?
It's easier to buy and run a 200 unit apartment than it is a 20 unit apartment from every perspective, from management. I mean, the hardest thing with smaller apartments is difficult to find good management. And that's where a lot of people get sideways. So if you got something above 100 units, the good management firms will look at it. They'll want to manage it and you can have people on site. And also just from a debt perspective, it's a heck of a lot harder to finance a 20 unit than it is a 200 unit.
Right, which is crazy. I've said it from the beginning, just when I first started getting into real estate, that it's crazy that it's easier to get a $20 million loan than it is to get a $200,000 loan.
Oh yeah, 100%.
And it's the same amount of paperwork. It's like, wait.
There's economies of scale in buying larger in every step of the process.
Yeah, well said. And that's something that if you are looking to scale up, which is kind of the theme of this show, like there's golden ticket number one, go bigger sooner. It's the same amount of work or less than.
Go bigger sooner and it's easier. It's totally counterintuitive.
It really is. It really is. And you know, it's funny thing is we're finding people right now who are kind of going the other way. I've interviewed a lot of people on this show who are saying, hey, we're staying under that 100 unit because there's less competition there. And they're finding a niche in it. But what they're doing is they're taking 340 units, maybe within a 5-mile radius of each other and using one property management company for 340 unit properties. But even there, you have to have strategy and get them all closed relatively close together in order to even begin to have it make sense.
We've implemented and deployed that strategy too. It absolutely works. You can build scale through multiple properties as long as they're geographically fairly close, right? And if you can have one management team manage them in kind of a, call it like a pod structure, you have your management team and your maintenance team for X amount of units and you can still get that scale. And that's worked. Like I did that here in Indianapolis. Like I won't go to a new market and buy a 50 unit because it's going to be alone on an island. But if it's a market where we already own property, then we just picked up a 29 unit, probably pick up another 27 unit here that we've been looking at. I mean, if you already have the infrastructure in place, it makes it possible.
Right. You're not adding any to your administrative burden.
I would say a huge lesson learned for me was we went down to Louisville and bought 30 units and we thought we were going to be able to get more. And we weren't. I mean, we do now, but we didn't for about a year. And that property was kind of alone on an island. And we had the management issues. We had issues finding maintenance people. We had to, revenue has outpaced all of our expectations, but expenses have also been higher than we planned on pro forma because we've had to go to like Sherman Williams and have them do the paint and different things like that because we just didn't have another option. So definitely I learned my lesson there on you don't want to put 30 units on an island.
Right. Yeah. What would you do differently in that scenario? I mean, would you have just not bought it or could you have been more strategic in having other properties lined up in the pipeline that would have helped kind of add to that portfolio and economies of scale? Or what would you do differently there?
Yeah, it's tough to say I wouldn't buy it because myself and all of our investors are still going to make a lot of money when we sell it. And it's still hitting our preferred returns and everything really has been good because the revenue growth and the other things that we've done on the property with other income and things have outpaced the expense increases. It's just that expenses have been higher than we projected. But I guess lesson learned would be in an ideal situation, you've got other properties in that market, or you're entering a market, buying a property that's at least 100 units that you can have management on site and can kind of be the hub in your hub and spoke model, if you will. And then you can acquire 30s and whatever around it. I mean, that would be the ideal situation. But at the same time, man, it's all going to work out.
Tell us a little bit about some of the steps you've taken. What were some strategic first steps you took out of the gate? You said, all right, I'm going to do multifamily investing. I am going to buy in X market. Like, how did you get the first deal done? What was some really pointed things? This is what I did to get to where I am.
Sure. So I think you got to look at it from two angles. You got to look at it from how do you get a deal? And then how do you get the money to actually be able to buy that deal? And even a third, depending on how are you going to get the debt to help you purchase that deal as well. And so when I set out, one, I found a great mentor. I found a couple of great mentors actually. And then I went through a couple of formal coaching programs as well. So you got to educate yourself. So I guess that's the first thing. You got to educate yourself first and you got to know what the hell you're doing. Because if your brokers know so fast, if you're a newbie and they can sniff them out. And so you got to at least learn how to speak the lingo and know what you're talking about. So you're not wasting people's time. But then it's all a relationship business. So from every aspect, it's about relationships. So it's about building relationships with the brokers and the markets that you want to be in. because they're the gatekeepers for these deals. I mean, for the majority, right? Especially if you're looking at bigger deals, yeah, you can do some mom and pop, some direct to seller stuff, but 90% it's going to be through brokers. Same thing from an investor standpoint. I mean, I'll tell you, lesson learned on the first deal that I went out to raise money for, I was a co-GP and partnering with some other folks, and I got to half of my raise target. So I only raised half the money that I thought I was going to be able to. The reason was because I hadn't done the prep work ahead of time. And it's just, you have to change people's perspective of who you are. So people knew me as, maybe it was, I played football with them in high school, or I was a fraternity brother in college, or I was a coworker or whatever. Even I was their boss, but they didn't know me as a multifamily expert. And it's very different to have a relationship where you can go out and get beers with somebody versus a relationship where somebody's going to hand you $50,000 of their hard-earned money to go invest in a property. And so you really have to be focused on building your credibility and showcasing your expertise. And I think you need to start that like 6 months before you actually ask people for money. So I didn't do that. And so I didn't raise as much money as I thought I could. And so that was a big lesson learned. The other thing I'd say just from a debt perspective is, I think a lot of people overlook the lenders and think that's kind of a guaranteed quantity, if you will. But you got to treat your lenders just like you treat your investors. I mean, they are the largest investors in the deal. You need to build relationships with them. And therefore, if you build relationships with those three groups ahead of time, when a deal comes, you'll be ready to take it down.
That's fabulous. You said you hadn't done the prep work ahead of time to let your investors know and kind of change their perspective on who you are. What did you do to change that?
Well, I became a thought leader. I put myself out there. I got out of my comfort zone. I started a podcast. I started a monthly networking event here in town. We're doing a weekly podcast now. I've been doing it for about a year and a half. And I started going to conferences. I started speaking at conferences. So those are big things that you can point to. But then just in general, I mean, I kind of began just eating, sleeping, and breathing real estate. And if you're just talking about it all the time and telling people about what you're doing, and you start to have success and they're seeing that track record, that's what makes people interested. And you start to have those proof points of, hey, man, maybe this is actually working. I think a lot of my friends weren't in on the first couple of deals. They were all kind of like, let's see how this goes. But deal probably three or four was when all of a sudden a bunch of like people that I knew growing up and historically started coming in and said, man, maybe this guy actually knows what he's doing.
Right. You're not just some random one-off deal. It's like, he's doing this a lot and he keeps doing it a lot. Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah. I think the important thing when you're first getting started is like, because the best thing to have is a track record of success, right? But you got to start somewhere. Everybody has to start somewhere. But I think the important thing is, if you don't have a track record around business, you need to have a compelling story that relates your current or past experiences or past successes and how that's going to make you successful in real estate.
Right. That's a great point, and not one that's talked about very often, is that transition phase between, hey, you know, I was super successful over here for you, a management consultant, super successful management consultant, but how you then position that experience into why that's going to help you. It's almost like a job interview of sorts, or a resume. Like, this is why I am going to be successful at that. So that's an interesting mind shift. I really like that. What have been some surprises or pitfalls maybe along the way that you've experienced?
Man, surprises or pitfalls. We had one just happen a couple months ago where we had gone direct to seller, and we had a seller who was interested, and we had an LOI in front of him. We had agreed on terms. And between the week that it took from LOI for my attorneys to get that PSA done, a broker swooped in and gave the guy an opinion of value that was a hell of a lot higher than what we were going to pay him. And the guy backed out and the broker took the listing and we lost the deal just because we didn't show up with contract in hand, ready to get that thing locked down. That was a big lesson learned for me. It was my second time going direct to seller, and just the deal is not done. I mean, it's not even yours until that thing is under contract. LOIs don't mean a whole hell of a lot. They're good for coming to terms, but that deal is not yours until that contract is signed.
Right. Man, that's brutal. I'm sorry to hear that. What would you do differently in that scenario?
Oh, well, what I've done is I went back to my attorney and I was like, look, like, this can't take a week every time. I was like, what is really changing? It doesn't seem like a lot is really changing. And, you know, you twist their arm a little bit and they kind of say, well, yeah, you're probably right. You probably could, you know, have like a boilerplate thing. And so I got a standard contract. I show up day one, contract in hand, already signed by me, and say, all you got to do is put your John Hancock here, man.
Oh man, that's brutal. I love that though. I mean, those are hard-earned lessons. If you're listening to this show, that may save you from losing a deal in the future. Yeah, I was wondering about that because I mean, it is unique in this industry how that is kind of the commonplace. Why do we even go through the LOI game in the commercial real estate space? I've never quite understood that because we don't do that residentially. I mean, it's just like, here's your contract and we sign and go. Why don't we do the same thing commercially? It sounds like, is that the path you're moving to now? You're just skipping the LOI phase?
No, depending. From a direct to seller standpoint, I think, yeah. I mean, LOIs are useful to come to terms before going through the cost and effort to draft a contract, right? So the reason you do the LOI is because you want to get those big things out of the way. Do you guys agree on price? Do you agree on earnest money? Do you agree on time frame? Right? Because if you don't agree on those things and you just put them all in a contract, well, now you've spent $5,000 to have an attorney draft a contract, but it was a non-starter from the beginning. So I think that's where it's useful. If there's a broker involved, then I think that usually goes pretty smoothly. And if it's somebody that cares about their reputation in the industry, it goes a lot smoother. But if it's somebody that maybe it's their only apartment they own and they're not used to it and they're just not used to the process, then I think that's where I'd be showing up day one with the contract and just saying, let's just get this thing signed. Give the rest out on the back end.
For sure. Man, that makes a heck of a lot of sense. Kent, I've really enjoyed our conversation today. Certainly learned a lot about how you got started, things you've done right, things you've done wrong. We've talked about financing, getting your lenders in place, getting your brokers in place, and just getting all your stuff set up for success. And I've enjoyed learning about how you guys have kicked this off. And thanks also again for sharing some of the mistakes and hard-learned lessons along the way that you've learned. Certainly appreciate that. Let's jump here into the final four questions. The first one is this: what is one tool or resource you find you can't live without?
Man, Calendly is like the best thing that's ever been invented. It's made my life so much easier. And it's basically replaced probably half the hours for my assistant, just being able to schedule directly and not have that back and forth.
Oh my gosh. Yes, absolutely. And it ties in with practically everything now. And most of those platforms do anymore. And that's crazy. That's a great resource. If you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Man, well, we already talked about a couple of them. So I'll bring up another one that we haven't talked about would just be understand what the heck a title company does, because a lot of people don't. And I bet most people don't read those title commitments that come back and read through them. But there's important stuff in there. For example, we just had a deal and we worked through it, but we found out through the title search that there was still a lien on the property from a loan from like 20 years ago. The loan had been paid off. The lien just hadn't been taken off. And so there wasn't a clean title. And so we had to work through that. But had we not have worked through that and not looked at that and just shown up to close, then it would have been an issue. So just understand what title company does and make sure you're reading those documents that they give you after they do the title search.
Man, that's absolutely true. And yes, I've been part of, gosh, at least two transactions where we bought the property and everything was paid off, but they never recorded it or never showed it as paid off even on the bank side. And you're still getting notices for accruing mortgage and interest payments. Like, wait, you guys already have the money. Like, this is paid off, gang. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Title companies are invaluable on that front. Question number three, when it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
A lot of what I'm doing right now, the way I view giving back is just trying to help people get started. I don't have a formal coaching program or anything, but I spend a lot of time talking with folks that are trying to do their first deal. So just trying to make myself available. I do that monthly meetup. A lot of that meetup is folks that are trying to get started. And I had a couple of people that really kind of catapulted my career and where I'm at. And because of those people, I am where I am today. So I'm just trying to give back in that way and try to, you know, maybe be that catalyst for some others.
That's awesome. Kent, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, just go to kentritter.com. And it's really simple. You can see my podcast. We've got a blog. We've got all kinds of investor resources. We've got some new videos we're putting up there. So you can get to everything else from kentritter.com. And if you're interested in investing, you can sign up there too to get on our list.
Man, that's fantastic. I love it. And lucky you, you got your first and last name.com. I've tried for that for years, but I can't get the guy to get rid of it.
It's pretty unique. There's not a lot of Kents out there, so it helps.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Kent, thank you again for your time today. This was a blast. I do appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.